Before September 11th, the bombing of the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City was the worst terrorist attack in American history. Cultural historian Ed Linenthal spent 5 years studying the emotional fallout from that tragedy, and now he's written a book called The Unfinished Bombing. Linenthal says people deal with such an awful event by telling stories that put the trauma in some perspective. We've seen the same thing in New York City. In the first days after the attacks, we had the heroic narrative, the rescue workers trying to find survivors. We've heard other narratives as well, of religious redemption and civic renewal. But Linenthal told Ann Strainchamps that we're still faced with a toxic narrative.
We need to have some respect for the power of evil that was present here and what it does not only to family members of those killed and wounded, not only to those who are working at the site, but the incredible ripple impact of this throughout thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, Oklahoma City, it was breathtaking to see how far out this spread, how many hundreds of thousands of people, for example, had to make decisions on whose funerals they went to, on how children, preschool children who were left home alone to watch recycled images of the Murrah Building thought it was a new building being blown up each time they saw it, and to this day kick the walls of new buildings before they go into it, on how police departments and EMSA teams and fire departments and the helping profession saw rise in domestic abuse and drug abuse and divorce and suicide rates. This is the toxic narrative. There's also a traumatic narrative that focuses on, for example, how victims of political violence are transformed into patients with an illness, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and how stories that are really often moral testimony or witness stories are transformed into trauma narratives, and how people are perceived as sort of passive victims suffering from an illness.
That's interesting, because that's one of the things you found in Oklahoma City, right? That the family members and victims did not always really welcome the counselors and psychologists who were moving in to try to help. In some cases, they really rejected the interpretations they got.
Yeah, absolutely. One psychologist said to me that people begin to inhabit diagnoses they're given. And many family members and survivors did, in fact, reject this and turn to various forms of active grieving, work for or against the death penalty, habeas corpus reform, work on victims' rights movement, and work on memorialization. Because work on memorialization became, for many people, a way of engaging the event itself.
Well, and there are two kinds of memorialization, right? Because there was also the just spontaneous outpouring that came from millions of people around the country. I mean, people sent letters and, I mean, all kinds of things happened, and that was just a spontaneous welling up.
When I read these thousands of letters and drawings and blueprints and design architects who would write in and say, I'm not religious, but last night I had a vision of what the memorial ought to be, and then blueprints an inch thick, which said to me something about the impact of this event on human consciousness. So there's that whole dimension of this unsolicited memorial vocabulary. There is, as you suggest, this sort of populist memorialization that we know so well from the Vietnam Veterans Memorial that has its roots certainly in Latino and Roman Catholic traditions in the past of memorializing sites of violence with a cross or with flowers. It becomes more complex at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial or at Oklahoma City. You have planned leavings, you have spontaneous leavings, and I've looked at all of this stuff in some detail at the Oklahoma City Memorial Foundation Archive.
What kind of things did people leave?
Well, people left all kinds of material items. They left teddy bears. They left pictures of angels. They left prayer cards. They left business cards. They left earrings. They left shoes. They left pieces of clothing. They left photographs. They left hard hats from some of the people that may have worked there. They left messages, floral arrangements of all kind, T-shirts, sports hats, towels from local hotel rooms, incredible range of material. Lots of What Would Jesus Do bracelets, for example, Native American dream catchers, all sorts of things.
What did the city do with all this
well,
stuff?
Well, it is all cataloged and archived in the Oklahoma City Memorial Archive, and it was an incredible thing to go through because it's a window into the culture and the sensibilities of the culture in a very interesting way.
Is the same kind of thing happening in New York City now, do you know? This kind of spontaneous,
yes,
welling up of artifacts?
It is. And I have not been, but a number of friends have told me that they're in front of fire departments and police departments and certainly near the site that there's an incredible array and archive of spontaneous memorialization that I believe now is going to be kept and cataloged as well.
Another parallel, I wonder if you would think of this as a form of memorialization. In the case of Oklahoma City, there was a photograph that emerged as a kind of icon. We've all seen it, the photograph of the firefighter holding the baby in his arms.
Yes, the fireman and the baby, one of the most powerful American icons of our time that really takes its place with the famous shot of the USS Arizona Memorial and JFK's assassination photographs and Kim Phuc in Vietnam running down the street, the naked girl who had just been napalmed, Chris Fields holding 1-year-old Bailey Ammon, her first birthday was the day before the bombing, in his arms before he hands her to an ambulance worker to take her away. That photograph, of course, becomes a natural idea for a memorial, and there are hundreds and hundreds of suggestions of this for a memorial. Statues were sent to the city, including an 11-foot, 2-ton cast-iron black statue of the fireman and the baby standing on a prone terrorist holding a hand grenade or some kind of explosive ready to throw it. This was going to go up in Oklahoma City with other statues. And Erin Ammon Koch, Bailey's mother, had to go to the mayor and I believe the governor saying that this is not how she wanted her child remembered.
I can't help but think how incredibly difficult for the real mother, for the other victims and families of victims, because what you're describing is a mourning process that got, in some ways, just out of control and couldn't be controlled or didn't revolve anymore around the people who were the most hurt.
Very difficult, although for some family members, there was solace to be taken in the kind of public eulogies that access to the media allowed them to do. But for Erin, for example, she told me, and I'll never forget one of our conversations, she was gracious beyond words to talk with me a number of times about these very painful and intimate things. When she went to buy funeral clothes for Bailey, a couple asked if they could have their picture taken with her. She said that she didn't feel comfortable going out in public for a long time because if she smiled, someone might think that she didn't love Bailey enough, didn't work actively on memorial projects because if she perhaps gave her opinion about something and it worked out that way, people might say, well, she just got her way because of Bailey. Some of the other mothers who had children killed grew resentful at the attention that Bailey got. So it was tremendously difficult for everyone. But that kind of spotlight, she handled it with a tremendous grace and courage that I'm simply awestruck by.
Well, one of the things that you write about that was so fascinating and so important for people in Oklahoma City was the family members really were able to take control, partly, of this whole process through the memorialization process, through deciding what kind of memorial there would be and how it would look and when it would go up and where it would go. That was really important.
It was incredibly important. And against all conventional wisdom by professionals who run design competitions, that while you can listen to family members, clearly their torment, their trauma, their grief is simply too much to allow them to be part, an essential part of the process, that they'll sort of muck it up and you need this cold, detached view. The mission statement of the memorial task force made it very clear that their voice was to be dominant.
What sorts of issues and debates did this group have to deal with?
They were very difficult issues to think about. For example, there was a street in front of the Mirror Building called Fifth Street, and it was closed temporarily. The plan was for it to open it again, but when memorial plans begin to arise, it was seen that they wanted a seamless memorial that stretched from the Mirror Building across Fifth Street to include the Journal Record Building, which had been badly damaged and now houses the Memorial Center Museum and store. Well, this was a real issue about closing Fifth Street. Different philosophical convictions about memorialization. Open the street. We don't want terrorists to alter our city landscape. Close the street. This is where people died in the street. They were carried out in the street. So eventually it was closed. Another issue that was tremendously difficult, it was decided in the mission statement that alongside some representation of the 168 who died, which is, of course, now in this tremendously moving exhibit of 168 empty lighted chairs with names on it, the names of survivors would be located somewhere on the site. Well, if you're going to put survivors' names up, who's a survivor? So the whole issue was tremendously volatile. And it's not an unusual one. People often sort of roll their eyes when I mention this issue. But if we believe that there's a difference between someone who came out of the Mura building who was badly injured, who lost not only his place, his or her place of work, but a community where they knew so many people, mm-hmm. where they perhaps were in the hospital, where then they had to decide who of the 10 funerals of my friends do I go to on 12 successive days. If there's a difference between that experience and someone driving by on I-40 who said, I saw it, I was terribly upset, I'm kind of a survivor too. I mean, if we want to draw a line between those experiences, now you're into memorial hierarchy. And the issue of memorial hierarchy is always important.
You know, I just can't help but think, listening to you, of course we're thinking about New York City.
Absolutely.
I mean, we're talking about 100-some people in Oklahoma and 6,000 in New York City. How on earth will this process ever play out?
I don't know. And the scale of New York makes the participatory model difficult. Not impossible, mm-hmm. perhaps, but difficult. New York is not Oklahoma City either. And we see there the philosophical poles have already been established. We must rebuild as an act of protest and as an act of defiance, as an act of getting back to business as usual. I heard someone say, interviewed about this, New York is a city of skyscrapers. We're not like Oklahoma City. Were I to make the case for the other pole, that this is land that has been transformed by the death of so many and that rebuilding and going back to business as usual is a kind of act of defilement, the first sentence, if I wanted to make this case, would be an unprecedented act of domestic terrorism calls for an unprecedented use of the most valuable real estate in New York City. I mean, that would be the first sentence for that argument.
Ed Linenthal is a cultural historian at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh. He talked with N. Strainchamps about his book, The Unfinished Bombing, Oklahoma City in American Memory.